Entering the final hour of Bullseye on the Afternoon on AM 930 WEOL, 13 minutes past 5 o'clock. We're happy that you've dialed in Andy Bullbarch and Matt Douglas. You've got us for another 45 minutes or so. We've had a lot of fun throughout the course of the show today, and we've been teasing our next guest ever since we got on the air right around 3 o'clock today. The book is Rally Round Cleveland, the story of the 1974 franchise-saving Cleveland Indians. Many of you know our next guest for all the work he has done for the better part of the last two decades as the play-by-play voice of the Akron Aeros, and at one point, of course, the Akron Rubber Ducks. Jim Clark joins us now on the hotline. Jim, how are you, my friend?
Great, Andy. How you guys doing today?
Oh, we are lovely, and we're very happy to have you on. And I had a chance to read some of the snippets of this book. Very, very interesting stuff, especially for guys like Matt and I who are a little bit younger. We weren't around during the 1974 season, so much of what we read earlier was definitely an education for us. But give us the story of the 1974 franchise-saving Cleveland Indians. What was it, Jim, that inspired you to write this book?
Well, I really felt, not, you know, one thing, I feel old now, but I was 19 in 74. But, you know, they almost lost a franchise in 58. Hank Greenberg, the great slugger, was in their front office. He wanted to move the club out. Well, they bought Greenberg out. The Indians stayed. At the end of 64, after three just awful years attendance-wise, they were on the market again. Seattle thought they had the Indians. Gabe Paul and the city got together, and they saved it. They bring back Rocky Colavito. They have a good year in 65. They're good in 68, but the bottom falls out. In 70, decent club, but nobody goes. Then there's real talk of moving half of their schedule to New Orleans in the early 70s. Nick Mulletti would buy the club, stop that. But in 71, 72, and 73, combined, attendance-wise at home, they drew less than 2 million people. Under 600,000 in 71, a little over it in 73. And my thought was, boy, if this kind of trend continues, with teams looking, with cities looking for baseball teams, one being our nation's capital for losing the Senators in the early part of the decade, if this continues, if something happens, they could be gone. So 74 comes. Slow start, then they make a huge trade. With the Yankees, they trade Chris Chambliss to the Yankees for four pitchers. Fritz Peterson, Steve Klein, Fred Bean, Tom Buskey. Two starters, two bullpen guys. And after opening day, when Gaylord Perry lost his first game, he wins 15 consecutive games. You look up in June after beer night, which happened, of course, in 74 as well, they're in first place or second place for a good part and third place for a good part of over 2 months between June, July, and August. And on Labor Day, they're only 4.5 games out of first place, the same as the 1948 Cleveland Indians. So the city fell in love again with their ball club. They drew a million, the first time since 1959. Fans came back. You had beer night. You had Gaylord Perry winning 15 straight games. Dick Bosman, no-hitter. But the Perry thing really gripped Northeast Ohio, and really all of baseball. He's going for his 16th straight win to tie the Major League record. They're in Oakland on a Tuesday night. Now, back in those days, people forget this. There were only some 48 games on local television. They were on Channel 8 then. Well, that game was not scheduled to be televised. They're thinking, we got to get this game on TV. So they put last-minute things together to get the game on. They have to fly Harry Jones, who called the games, to Oakland. He gets there in the fourth inning. Monty Moore, the ace, slides over, calls the game. I can remember vividly. It's about 1 o'clock, 1:15. My dad gets home from work at midnight. We're watching the game. And Dave Duncan slugs a two-run homer, and the Indians go on top. I live in Akron. Look out my front door. Every light in every house in the street, they're all on.
Wow.
Watching the Indians. They were gripping Ohio again. It's baseball, and only baseball can do this. It's just day in, day out, from April to October. And the city fell in love again with their club. And I think, even though it crashed and burned, as Joe Tate would say, in the last 3 weeks, they recaptured the hearts of Cleveland for baseball again in 74.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned. I mean, the idea of playing 35 games in New Orleans in the early 70s before Nick Mullitty bought the team and kind of squashed that idea. Take us behind the scenes there, because I think in today's day and age, that just doesn't even seem like it's possible. But, I mean, as you've explained here before, I mean, the attendance numbers were dwindling, interest was dwindling. Give us an idea as to how that came about, the possibility even of playing 35 games in New Orleans.
Well, two things happened. First, George Steinbrenner thought he had the club with Al Rosen. He thought he was going to buy the club in 70, right around there. He thought he had a deal to buy the Indians. And the story supposedly goes is a drunken Vernon Stouffer owned the club, squashed the deal, and kept them. And then Mullitty came in, and here's all this talk of New Orleans, and New Orleans thought they had him as well. It was 35 to 40 games, which is incredible. I think it would have killed the franchise had they done that. Another Ohio team did a similar thing, but not as many games. You remember the Cincinnati Royals, who are now in Sacramento in the NBA?
Yes.
They would play handfuls of games at the Cleveland Arena in the 60s, 8 to 10 games. And when you only play 41 home games in the NBA, they were playing games in Indianapolis, Dayton, Cleveland. After 5 years of that, they were gone to Kansas City. I think if the Indians would have actually done that and played that many games away from Cleveland, it would have killed the franchise, would have turned people off completely, because they're always number two to the Browns. And the Browns were still good in 69 and 70. They went to the NFL title game in 69. They were Monday Night Football's first game in 70. They were always going to be there. And they still are, of course. But if they'd have gone and played that many games out of the city, they would have been gone within, I think, 5 years, if not less. Would have killed it.
Well, and as you mentioned earlier too, Jim, I mean, look, back then it was a little bit different. Now these games are so readily accessible. You can watch them on your phones at any time of the day. But back then, it was awfully tough to follow your team. And if you take just about almost half of the home dates away, it would have made it almost impossible.
Well, you're living then at that time with Bob Neal and Herb Score on the radio, and a handful of games on television, which were just weekend games and a few night games. And if you take that part away, holy smokes, it just, now I think there's too much on. You know, I think it hurts the Indians right now. They're 20th in attendance, and they have a team that's going to compete again for an American League pennant, and you can see too many games in way too many fashions. But then though, you couldn't do that. And in 74, there's only 48 games on. They're starting to draw again. 10 times they drew 30,000 or more. 4 times over 40,000. Back in those days, when you're at 500,000, 600,000 and you almost double it, that's tremendous. That's a huge, that's money in the pocket for the first time in many, many years for the guys who ran the club.
When you look at that blockbuster trade that you alluded to earlier, Chris Chambliss going to the Yankees for 4 different pitchers, and when you look back on that trade, and you mentioned that, you know, this is around the time where you were a teenager, but looking back, you know, this is going back almost 35 years now. When you look back on that trade, what was the initial reaction to that?
Well, we were stunned. He had just won the game that night on a Friday night against the Angels, beat Nolan Ryan with a hit. We're driving home. Then, of course, the big name in radio was Peter J. Franklin. Pete Franklin, the king of talk, really the king of talk radio for sports talk. And he uses the word blockbuster. And we were stunned that they traded Chris away. Everyone thought, here's a guy that may win a batting title. He was rookie of the year. He's still young. But their thought was, we got to find 2 more starters to go with Jim and Gaylord Perry. Because Jim Perry had been brought back to the Indians in the offseason and had a great year. So their thinking was Steve Klein, Fritz Peterson, we filled them into the staff, we got a shot. But Klein had been a 16-game winner by the Yankees a couple of years before that, but he had elbow and shoulder problems. If Steve Klein pans out, that's a great deal. But he was hurt on and off, was only in Cleveland 1 year, and had issues with the arm and shoulder all the time. Chambliss goes on to have a great career with the Yankees, wins the pennant for him against Kansas City. has a great career. But at that point, Tom Buskey comes in, saves 18 games. Peterson wasn't bad. Now, Bean was awful. He was good before getting to Cleveland. He could never get on track in those fire engine red Indian uniforms. Just could not get on track. But two of the guys were okay. You just kept hoping Klein could somehow find himself, because he would have been he was outstanding in 72 with the Yankees, 71 or 72. Great year. Great career ahead of him.
Jim Clark, author of the book Rally Around Cleveland, story of the 1974 franchise-saving Cleveland Indians, is our guest here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. One of the other things that you mentioned about that magical 1974 season, the Indians, of course, acquired Frank Robinson late in the year, and there's a near fight between he and Gaylord Perry in the clubhouse. What happened here?
Well, they got Frank off the waiver wire, which at that point it was too late. But, you know, you thought, hey, you're still five games out. Hey, why not? Well, Gaylord finds out they're going to renew Frank's contract for 75, his playing contract. Everybody in the world thought he's the next manager. For poor Ken Aspromonte was going to be gone, But Frank and Gaylord finds out how much Frank's going to make. He's thinking, hey, I've been towing the line here for 3 years. I won a Cy Young in 72, winning 24 games. He wins 21 in 74. So Gaylord comes out in the papers and tells everybody who will listen, I want one more dollar than Frank Robinson. Well, Frank didn't like that, and they got to the clubhouse after the off day, and they got together, and Frank goes, yo, Gaylord, I hope you get all the money you want. But if you ever mention my name again in print, we're going to have issues. And they almost came to blows. They were separated. And, of course, Frank became the manager, and he had shipped Perry out halfway through 75. So, you know, it was just this, besides beer night, which was, of course, the story in baseball. And Mike Hargrove, I talked with Mike about that. Mike was the Rangers' first baseman. Now, I was there beer night. So I had a firsthand taste of that, so to say. But one of the most unbelievable things that I've ever seen in my life. I was on crutches with a broken foot, and when the Indians tied the game in the ninth inning and the fans began to go to the field and they wanted to grab, a guy wanted to grab Jeff Burrow's hat. Well, Burrow thought they're taking a punch at him. So he swings and it all breaks loose. They try to take my crutches away from me. He was on the field. I had to fight folks to keep my crutches. It was crazy.
Jim, when you talk about things happening in 1974, obviously the success the ball club was having on the field, but you bring up the beer night incident, you bring up Frank Robinson, Gaylord Perry going at it in the clubhouse, and as you pointed out, I mean, talking in the papers, that was the big form of media back then, and of course radio, as you mentioned, the games weren't on TV. Did all of that kind of come in, and I don't want to use the word conspire, but was that sort of, I don't want to say debacle either, but those two big media stories, did that kind of help resurrect the Indians and put them not only on regional level, but people give them notice a little more around the country?
Well, beer night was national news, of course, which wasn't the good way. But I tell you, you talk about getting put on the map for one night, and they had more beer nights after that.
Wow.
Never had an issue. Now, the Frank thing, he was on waivers twice. Nobody claimed him. He said, the next team that claims me, I don't care who it is, I'm going. Well, it was Cleveland. And they become national news again because everyone's thinking, here's the first black manager in baseball. It's going to be Frank Robinson. They would not renew Aspromonte's contract, which was a shame because he did a great job at that club. They battled injuries and hamstrings all season long. You had Gaylord Perry and George Hendrick, the Indians' really star center fielder. George was lazy, immature, young, and lazy. And he and Gaylord did not get along, hurt the club at times. And Aspromonte, with guys getting hurt, Buddy Bell, John Ellis, Jack Brohammer, he kept that team afloat, had him in first place in June and July, second place more than anything else for almost a three-month period. Had him in a race, and his reward was no new contract and fired the last week of the season.
Really?
And they never had the success under Robinson they had under Aspromonte.
Yeah.
No, never had it. It was never in a race.
It's incredible stuff. I mean, it's, again, for Matt and I, looking back at all that went down that season, I find it interesting that, you know, not being around back then, how much went on? Because it's just so weird how 30 years later, if stuff like this went on today, you'd hear about it in 15 seconds. It would be all over the place. It would go viral. But you look back then about how an incredible season it certainly was, a big-time pennant race, and then all of that was going on with all this off-the-field drama. You know, you talk about the near fight between Frank Robinson and Gaylord Perry, and then you talk about beer night and all the drama surrounding that as all. Given all of that, and you know, and basically a new roster as well with the trade of Chris Chambliss to get four arms coming back in return, given all of that drama, are you surprised the Indians were able to somehow, some way, still stay in the thick of things?
You know, I think a lot of the guys were so young that it just blew right over their heads. The Buddy Bells, the Brohammers, the Charlie Spikes, the John Lowensteins, and then you had a guy like Perry who could say the right things, and Gaylord and Jim could settle them down when it was needed. They had a good mixture of veterans with the youth. But, you know, one of the biggest things which it gets lost is how the fans came back, which was stunning because you really thought that, well, maybe they'll latch on. But how they would do that then, when your only outlets were, there was only three TV stations that had nightly news, 3, 5, and 8. You had the two papers in town, the press and the plane dealer, but the biggest booster who could stir anything, it was Pete Franklin. Pete Franklin, when you went to an Indians game on the way home, you turned on Pete Franklin driving home. On off night, you listened to Pete Franklin. And when they had the beer night incident the week before, it all began in Texas, when Lenny Randle ran over Milt Wilcox on a play in the eighth inning down the first baseline. Well, you had Pete Franklin, hey, the Rangers are in town next week. We got to get him back. It's our night for revenge. And on top of everything else, the Ranger manager, Billy Martin, it's just beer night. I got no worries. Nobody will be there anyway. And Pete ran with that. There were just so many things that played into everything and made it a great summer. I mean, one of the things people also that in those days, you could sit in the bleachers for 50 cents. 50 cents. General admission, $2.50. Park in the old Muni lot for 50 cents. So you could go for practically nothing and go to and see a Major League Baseball game. Part of it.
Yeah, well, then to top it all off, when you've got beer night, here's my question for you. Because beer night is certainly something that takes on a life of its own. But you mentioned you were there, you were on crutches. Seeing this thing develop and being there, you could certainly probably sense something was coming at some point. Jim, at what point during the beer night game did you sense that things could get out of hand?
Well, they were dancing on top of the dugouts, the females were. They ran on the field to give Nestor Shalek a kiss, the home plate umpire. Tried to get to the Ranger third baseman, Tom Grieve. The cherry bombs were coming out of the upper deck constantly, all night long. And fans were just running out of the field, just to run out of the field during a baseball game. I can remember one of my favorite parts was some guy jumps out of right field. He runs by George Hendrick. George lays his hand out. He gives him five. He runs to Spikes first. He gets five. Runs to Hendrick. He gives him five. He goes left field. Lowenstein gives him five. He goes left, center, right, jumps over the fence, and goes back in the line to get beer. Streakers on the field. Father and son streakers through the outfield. Cops caught him. And you just got the feeling that, you know, this is it's getting way too far out of hand because they sold the beer behind the center field fence. You could get to it by going down the runways in left and right field. And, you know, thank heavens there were only around 25,000 fans. Great night like tonight, warm, 75, 80 degrees, not a cloud to be found. If there had been 40,000 fans or 50,000 fans, it could have really been ugly. They were lucky. There were only 24,000, 25,000 fans that night.
Wow.
But you could see it coming in the fifth and sixth inning. You could see it unfolding. I'm sitting here thinking, as of course my 19-year-old feeble mind, if we lose to Pennant by one game because of this forfeit, first thing I thought after the game, if we lose by one game. Now, the next time we went back up, it was like a recital. Mild clapping of the hands, 7,000 under best behavior.
Wow.
So many things in one year.
You said you went back up after. Did they take any precautions? I mean, after that had happened, I mean, obviously they didn't do another beer night, I feel, the week after, but was there anything else put in place, or did the fans just calm down after that?
When the next night was just like any other normal night.
Huh.
The story goes that in the sixth inning beer night, the Indian hierarchy, they just got out of it and left.
Wow.
They could see it coming. Not many cops were downtown. In fact, the cops later told Joe Tate, they heard him on the radio talking. They go, we better get down there. This might get out of hand. They heard Joe and Herb on the air, and that's how they got down to the stadium.
Wow.
Yeah. To help.
Yeah, I remember hearing that same story. As a matter of fact, I think Joe Tate mentioned that in his book, that there were cops many years later that would tell him that, hey, we didn't realize things had gotten so crazy until he heard your call, and then we figured, oops, as you just mentioned, wait a minute, we better get down there and offer an extra hand. Jim, before we let you go, I'll let our listeners know where they can go to find this book. I know it's available on eBay, but it'll be available on many other platforms. I understand it's making its way into team shops as well. Where can our listeners go to get a copy of the book?
Right now it's eBay only. We're working on Amazon, the Indian team shop, and the Ducks team shop as well. But right now it's eBay. If you just type in Cleveland Indians book, Rally Around Cleveland, it'll take you right to it.
Very good stuff. Well, Jim, this is a blast. This was so much fun. And obviously, again, for Matt and I, an education for us, because we weren't around when this team was beginning to blossom and certainly making its mark, bringing back to life baseball in a city where certainly it's been alive and well for a very long time. Always appreciate the time, my friend. We'll do it again soon.
Andy, thank you so much, guys. You guys have a great night. Again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. Again, Jim Clark joining us, author of Rally Round Cleveland, story of the 1974 franchise-saving Cleveland Indians. Make